You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
We didn't do anything after Sandy Hook, where 21st graders were mowed down in their classrooms along with six of their teachers. And we didn't do anything after the Pulse nightclub massacre, where 49 people were killed and 58 others were wounded by a lunatic with an AR-15. And we didn't do anything after Las Vegas, where 58 concertgoers were killed and 851 people were injured, again by a maniac with an AR-15. Maybe it'll be different this time, because the victims, the survivors at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, are calling bullshit on the NRA and the president the NRA owns and the members of Congress the NRA owns.
The people in the government who were voted into power are lying to us. And us kids seem to be the only ones who notice and are prepared to call BS. Companies trying to make caricatures of the teenagers nowadays, saying that all we are is self-involved and trend-obsessed, and they hush us into submissions when our message doesn't reach the ears of the nation. We are prepared to call BS. Politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this. We call BS. They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS. They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS. They say guns are just tools like knives and are as dangerous as cars. We call BS. No, they say that no laws could have been able to prevent the hundreds of senseless tragedies that have occurred. We call BS. That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS.
That was Emma Gonzalez, a 17-year-old Stoneman Douglas student, speaking at a rally in Fort Lauderdale over this weekend. I want to say how impressed I am and how hopeful I've been made by the students at Stoneman Douglas. They've called for a march on Washington on March 24th. Go to marchforourlives.com for info. And they're demanding what 90% of Americans say they want, including a majority of gun owners. Mandatory background checks, closing the gun show loophole, a ban on weapons of war like the AR-15. Something else that gives me hope? Many of these kids will be able to vote in the 2018 midterm elections. All of them will be able to vote in the 2020 presidential election. They're not just calling BS. Along with the new group, NoNRAMoney.org, they're planning to make taking money from the NRA as toxic as accepting money from NAMBLA. An unfair comparison? The North American Manboy Love Association, a powerless organization that exists mostly in the imaginations of anti-gay conservatives, and the National Rifle Association, an immensely powerful organization that owns Congress and controls the GOP. One supports child rape. The other supports child sacrifice. Both oppose reasonable age limits. I'd say it's a fair comparison. And while we're tossing ideas about gun control onto the table, I wanted to throw this out there. Every time there's a mass shooting after Sandy Hook and San Bernardino and Orlando and Las Vegas and Virginia Tech and Aurora and Sutherland Springs and on, gun sales spike and gun stocks rally. These massacres, all these dead children and dead music fans and dead churchgoers, they are good for people in the gun business. They're so predictably good for the gun business that on some level, and because I like to think people are basically good, let's say on some deeply subconscious level, this has to function as an incentive. If you sell a gun to someone who looks like they might turn around and shoot up a high school or a church or a movie theater or a kindergarten classroom or a nightclub, you have to know on some level that everyone in your industry stands to profit. So here's an idea, my idea, and no, I haven't run it past a lawyer who specializes in that sweet spot where commercial law intersects with constitutional law, but I am tossing it out here anyway. When there's a mass shooting, which is defined as any shooting with four or more victims, Every gun shop and gun range in the country has to close its doors for a month, and all trading of gun company stocks are suspended for 3 months. If it's too soon to talk about gun control in the days and weeks immediately after a mass shooting, it's too soon to buy and sell guns or stocks in gun manufacturers in the wake of a mass shooting. This would remove the incentive to sell guns to just anyone, because it wouldn't be just the lives of students and concertgoers and movie theater patrons that would be on the line, but the livelihoods of gun merchants and the profits of gun manufacturers too. And why shouldn't the people who profit from gun sales have some skin in this sick game too? Some skin and some blood and bone and marrow and internal organs and brain tissue. So yeah, anytime there's a mass shooting, gun stores, gun ranges, padlocked, buying and selling gun manufacturer stock, suspended. And a mass shooting, again defined as any shooting with four or more victims, we have one of those in the United States every day. So adopting my plan could result in the permanent padlocking of every gun store in America. Call it an intended consequence. All right, coming up on today's show, tons of your Q's, lots of my A's, and we have two guests for you today on the micro edition of the Savage Lovecast. Caitlin Doty from the Order of the Good Death joins us to talk about what you can and cannot put on your tombstone. It is relevant to a sex and relationship advice podcast, as you will see. And joining us on the Magnum subscription edition of the Savage Lovecast, which you can subscribe to at savagelovecast.com. The Magnum is twice as long and has no ads. Go to savagelovecast.com. Again, to subscribe. Joining us on the Magnum, author Roxane Gay, author of Hunger and Bad Feminist, is here to talk about her new advice column in the New York Times. All that coming up on today's show.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code SAVAGE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Bull and Branch, luxury, affordable, fair trade certified sheets. Get $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping by going to bullandbranch.com and entering SAVAGE. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv produces audio-based fitness workouts, programs, and challenges created by certified expert personal trainers available online and through their mobile app so you can work out just the way you like. New members get 50% off an annual membership plan featuring unlimited workouts. Visit aptiv.com/savage and the discount will be automatically applied during checkout. That's aaptiv.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. This is a 31-year-old queer poly cis woman from upstate New York, and I have a pretty big dilemma. The backstory is that I've been married for 5 years with my husband for almost 10. He has always been eager to have kids, and I have always been not terribly interested in the idea, maybe at most. The subject has gotten more tense and urgent for him as we get older, and I just recently realized / admitted to myself that I don't want children at all. And furthermore, that all of the maybes I have given have come from a place of guilt or pressure, feeling like I'm supposed to want them, like, or that there's something wrong with me because I don't. Now I have to figure out how and when to have this conversation with him. To complicate matters, I worry about having the conversation because lately, like the last few years or so, any conversation I try and have with him that involves something he doesn't want to hear or feels is a criticism results in immediate anger and closes off any constructive conversation. This includes me trying to talk about feeling like he doesn't want to bother paying attention to what turns me on in bed or remember what are good things or bad things or ways to interact with me when I have an anxiety attack, which has been something I've dealt with the entirety of our relationship. And no matter how calmly or neutrally I try to talk about these things, it's almost always anger, or sometimes I get blank silence. I'm just not sure how to have such a big conversation with that.
A partner who reacts with anger when you attempt to have a conversation with them about something they might not want to hear, when you have to tell them something that they might not want to hear, particularly about your sexual needs, sexual comfort, wants, desires, aspirations, goals, and they react angrily if it's not just what they want to hear. That's manipulative, controlling behavior. They are attempting to prevent you from being who you are, doing what you want to do, informing them about your needs. That's crap. And if you can't have that conversation with that person without them reacting in anger, don't have that conversation with them. Send them a fucking letter, write them an email, or have a moderated conversation with that person with a third party where they're going to be less likely to reach for anger because there's a witness in the room who can broker the discussion, who can lead the discussion. Get thee to a couples counselor, go. Your partner who reacts angrily when your sex life comes up, when you want to give him points or tips, who is going to react angrily when you inform him that you have made a decision about children and it isn't the decision he would like you to make. Yeah, you want a referee in the room. He will be less likely to go to anger and attempt to manipulate you in front of someone who's going to be there to call him on that. Doesn't mean he won't get angry at you later. Doesn't mean he won't get angry at you after, but at least you'll be able to have a conversation with him that isn't short-circuited by rage, by manipulative, controlling, strategically deployed anger. And the time to have this convo with him is now, is soon. You're 31 years old. You guys have been together, married for 5 years. He wants kids. Not going to happen with you. So if that's going to happen for him, you need to tell him that he has to go find a new partner. You guys are poly. I've met poly couples who don't have kids together but have kids with their secondaries. So it is possible for him to have children with another partner. That could, of course, change the center of gravity, really shift the center of gravity away from you two as a couple and toward him as a parent partner to his secondary. And if he wants to be present in his children's lives on a daily basis, perhaps he'll wind up living with that partner and you two could still be married, still be a couple, but you would become the secondary. There's a lot more that's possible, a lot more to discuss, a lot more to negotiate in a poly relationship with this conflict than in a monogamous exclusive relationship with this conflict. In an exclusive monogamous relationship with this conflict, it's over. You're going to have to go your separate ways. You guys can have a conversation about staying together as you are now or in some different de-emphasized role that will allow him to have what he wants with someone else and allow you to have what you want still with him. And you two still together, if he can handle it. And you know what? I doubt he can. Because somebody who goes right to rage, right to anger, when their partner tells them something they do not want to hear, I don't think has the emotional maturity to be poly, much less to be in a long-term relationship with one person and create a family with another.
Hey, Dan, this is Ahmad. I've been with my boyfriend for 3 years. Everything is great. I love him to death. But I've been having this one little problem. Whenever we want to have sex, or I want to have sex at least, like after a long day or traveling, he would not let me unless he showers. I asked him and he told me that he thinks that it's unhygienic and he doesn't want me to transfer that bacteria to me or him. When he said that, I felt dirty and it kind of turned me off a little bit. And I don't know if I should talk to him about this or I should just let him be because that's what he's comfortable with and just, you know, keep my fetishes. I'm not sure if it's a fetish or I don't know if it's natural or not, but what should I do? Because sometimes I fantasize about, you know, smelling, honestly, balls or something, you know. I'm sorry for, you know, being too disgusting, but this is who I am. Help.
I have some experience with balls. Freshly washed balls and not so freshly washed balls. And it seems to me, if I recall correctly, that it doesn't take long for freshly laundered balls to return to stinky ball stage. It doesn't take long for the aroma of balls to reassert itself. That can happen in 10, 15, 20 minutes. So you may be able to work around your boyfriend's batshittery about having to take a shower and scrub himself Silkwood style, 40-year-old pop culture reference there for the kids, Silkwood style before you two are intimate. Just extend the foreplay, roll around for a little bit, turn the heat up in the house so that he sweats a little bit, and his natural scent will reassert itself, provided he's not using incredibly stinky soaps or dousing himself in cologne. And if he's a germaphobe or a bacteriaphobe, I hope he's not dousing himself in cologne. That shit is expensively marketed rat piss. And if he's afraid of the natural scents and pheromones and aromas and sweat that his body produces, I hope he's not drenching himself in expensively marketed rat piss. But you like man smells, or you like how your man smells. Just delay. You can passively resist his batshittery by telling him to go take a shower because you want to have sex, and then telling him, oh, wait, let's finish this 3.5-hour Netflix special first, and let him marinate on the couch a little bit until his natural scents reassert themselves. Good luck. Here at Savage Lovecast Industries, we really want someone to join you in bed, and therefore, you must be prepared with lovely, comfortable sheets. So you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple of $100. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. And Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company are all talking about Boll & Branch. Boll & Branch also only uses sustainable and responsible methods of sourcing and manufacturing. They donate a portion of every sale to charity to help fight human trafficking while preserving fair prices for consumers. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love your new sheets, send them back for a refund, but I doubt you'll want to send them back. Either way, there's no risk and no reason not to give these sheets a try. To get you started right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com, promo code SAVAGE. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code SAVAGE, bollandbranch.com, promo code SAVAGE.
Hi, Dan. So about a month ago, I found out that my boyfriend of 5 months is really into like garter belts. So I've never bought lingerie before, but like a week ago, I decided I was just going to buy the lingerie and then just like figure out what to do about it later. But now that I'm thinking about like when to bring it out, or like when to tell him about it, or like when to wear it, I'm just realizing that I'm not super excited by the idea. Like, I don't know how to feel sexy in it. I can't like it. Like, I've never fantasized about me wearing lingerie. So I don't really know what to do, but I want to do this thing and I want it to be fun and sexy, and I already bought the things. So I'm just wondering what your advice to me would be about just trying to feel good in it.
My advice would be to wear the garter belt and hose yourself once or twice under your jeans or skirt if you go to work without surprising the boyfriend with it. Just wear it for your own comfort, so you can see what it's like to wear these kinds of undergarments and to do it just for yourself, just as an experiment, without the heightened stakes of, and now I'm going to give my boyfriend his ultimate fantasy as I wear these garments that I've never worn before and I'm probably not very comfortable in, or at least the first time I put them on, I'm not going to be very comfortable in them. And I used to do drag a long time ago. I wore garter belts. I wore hose. You can get used to it pretty quick. And I was a dude. I got used to it pretty quick. And I got comfortable in them pretty quick. But it wasn't sexual for me. And I think that element of his sexual expectations puts an additional layer of pressure on you, because you're not wearing a garter belt and hose, you're performing the garter belt and hose. So the first few times you wear them, don't wear them as the performance. Just wear them to see what it feels like to have them on for your own physical comfort. And then when you want to wear them for him, have him put them on you. And in that moment, hopefully, if things go right, you will tap into his excitement, that his excitement, his arousal at seeing you in these garments will cause you to take pleasure not in the wearing of the garments, because you could give a shit, but in his pleasure. And that's really something that everybody should be able to do for their partner. Everybody's not going to have perfect overlap on turn-ons and kinks and pleasures and what they like. People shouldn't do things that leave them traumatized. People shouldn't do anything that has them curled up in the fetal position on the floor afterwards, sobbing in the bathroom. But for our partners, particularly in sexually exclusive relationships, we should make an effort to meet their reasonable needs. And putting on a certain kind of underpants for your partner, not an unreasonable ask. Not something that, I don't want to say we should hesitate to do, but something that we should work our way up to doing with a partner. It's fine to hesitate. It's fine to take a moment. And that's what I advise you to do at the top of this response. Take a moment. Wear them for yourself. Wear them at a time you're not going to see him. But when the time comes, wear them for him. And if he is super excited and super turned on by you in these garments, bask in that. Look at what you're doing with and for him with an assist from these garments. And take pleasure in his pleasure. And hopefully the pleasure you take in his pleasure will help you bridge that discomfort gap that you're feeling, because these do nothing for you. Hopefully his turn on, seeing him excited, hopefully that does something for you. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers, available through a super useful mobile app. Aptiv makes the highest quality training available to everyone with a carefully selected group of certified personal trainers that guide you through every workout. Plus, Aptiv's in-house music production team partners with every trainer to create music playlists that are perfectly timed to the intensity and pace of your workout. When you need that extra boost, the music keeps you going and keeps you motivated. When you're ready to slow things down, the intensity of the music dials down with you. It's a flexible audio workout format, so you can work out just the way you like. And Aptiv has classes for all fitness levels, from beginner to intermediate to advanced. And with more than 2,500 workouts available on the platform and 30-plus new classes added each week, there's always a new workout to try. They offer a full maternity program broken down by trimester, so you can work out and build strength for a healthy pregnancy and delivery, and a ton of other features. Subscriptions start at $14.99 billed monthly or $99.99 for an annual membership. For a limited time, new members get 50% off an annual membership, which is just $49.99 for the whole year of unlimited workouts. Visit aptiv.com/savage to get that discount. That's aptiv.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 28-year-old female from Canada, and I just have a question. I'm wondering how my boyfriend was recently in a snowboarding accident, and so he's housebound for probably the next 6 months. It was a really bad accident. And I'm just wondering how we can keep desire and passion alive in that time, because we had a really exciting, fun relationship as it normally is in the beginning. And I'd just like that to continue, but it's hard to do when you're housebound for 2 months and he can't really move.
You can't do the things that you were doing, but you can talk about the things that you've done, and you can talk about the things that you're going to do once your boyfriend is back on his feet. And snowboarder to snowboarder, my heart goes out to your boyfriend. But your sex life is going to be diminished over the next 6 months. It can't be what it was before the accident. Hopefully it'll be what it was and better again once he's recovered, once he's healed. And you can look forward to that by dirty talking about it. Lay with him. He's housebound. He's in bed. Lay with him. Masturbate together. Get some vibrators and toys. He can't jump around the room right now. You can't have athletic sex, but you can experiment with vibrators, perhaps even insertables and insertable vibrators, to give each other pleasure, to stimulate each other's genitals, and engage in acts of mutual masturbation. Maybe you can ride him a little bit when he's feeling a little bit better and he can be inside you. But if he's been in a bad snowboarding accident and is housebound, and right now for the next 2 months is flat on his back in bed, yeah, it can't be what it was, but it can be that again. It won't be that again if you become resentful over the next 6 months, because it isn't what it was. Then it never will be again if you stew in resentment. Do what you can do. Use the biggest sex organ that you both have, which is between your ears, not your legs, as the saying goes, and talk up a storm about all the hot shit you did and all the hot shit you're gonna do once he's back on his feet, as you two masturbate together.
This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. Creating your site with Squarespace is a simple, intuitive process. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. Design a great-looking online store with Squarespace's award-winning templates, customizable settings, and more, all without a single plugin. It's incredibly easy to use, but if you need help, they offer 24/7 customer support. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code SAVAGE to get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com and enter offer code SAVAGE.
Hey, Dan. This is a 30-year-old in the Midwest. I have a question when it comes to parenting and being sex positive. I have a 10-year-old, and he has a cell phone. And I routinely will check his search history, which maybe is my first mistake. The other day when I was checking, I found a recent search for Pornhub. Well, I was a little bit surprised, as I feel like 10 is a little young. I was initially more freaked out about the fact that I was afraid that he may be sharing these videos with his friends, which would possibly get him into trouble. I did hear about some children ended up getting in trouble with sharing some explicit photos, resulting in some charges being placed on one of the children. So my question for you is, how do I address this with him without A, embarrassing him, and B, with really driving home the point that I'm not upset that he's looking at porn, but I want him to understand kind of the ramifications if he were to share that with kids of his own age.
I just want to say this first because I have a feeling I'm about to go off on a really long rant about a lot of the issues that you touch on in your call. There are phones out there that don't have the internet on them. There are phones out there that don't have cameras on them. Your 10-year-old, if your 10-year-old is going to Pornhub on his internet-capable phone, yeah, maybe your 10-year-old isn't old enough or responsible enough to have a phone with the internet. So get him a different kind of phone. That is something that you can do. And a phone is not a constitutional right, and you can take your kid's phone away. We frequently did that when our kid was young. There's no way to have this convo with your kid about porn, even if he wasn't looking at porn, without embarrassing your kid. And you do need to have these embarrassing conversations with your kids about porn. And almost all of them are going to find it and are going to see it. We give them all telephones and they carry the internet around with them in their pockets. They also carry porn production studios around with them in their pockets. And kids have been arrested and charged by runaway, idiotic prosecutors all over the country for possessing or distributing child pornography when the pictures that they had or shared were of themselves. And these laws, child porn laws, are designed to protect children from being exploited, not by themselves, but by predatory adults. And to throw children in jail, to slap a sex offender label on a child and really destroy that kid's life because that kid took a picture of their own junk and shared it with their own boyfriend or girlfriend is insane. And it happens constantly. And you should bring that to your child's attention. The danger, of course, is saying to your kid, never do this. Puts it in your kid's head to do this taboo, transgressive thing that freaks out and pisses off the adults. But you still have to risk that reaction by acquainting them with the potential horrible consequences. Not to be sex panicky about it, but when the potential consequences, if the worst should happen, are so severe, so life-altering as to be in all practical purposes life-ending, and there have been cases where kids who were facing charges that might put them on sex offender registries committed suicide, you have to err on the side of instilling a little bit of panic in your kid. But this is just, you saw porn. You saw Pornhub on his phone. There's a whole other conversation you need to have with him about that, which is, all right, so you saw some porn. Sorry I invaded your privacy, but you know what? You're 10 years old. You don't have a right to privacy. And I, as a parent, have a responsibility to monitor where you're going on the internet. Where are you going on the phone that I gave you and that I pay for and that I can take from you and stop paying for if you're going to misuse it? And I understand that you're curious about sex, and it's completely natural to be curious about sex, and you will see more porn in the next few years. I have no doubt. And here's the thing. And then you have to tell your kid that porn distorts, that porn bears as much resemblance to sex as action movies bear to daily life. Life is not Fast and the Furious. That's not what it's like when your dad and I drop you off at school. That's not how people drive. And porn is often the Fast and the Furious of human sexuality. It's a distortion. It's an exaggeration. A lot of what you see is performance. And played up. It's kabuki theater sex. And you need to put that seed in your kids' head so they watch porn with a critical eye. So they watch porn not expecting that that's what the sex that they're going to have will look like. And you need to have a conversation about consent. Because a lot of porn, adults watch porn, and we understand that the performers are consenting adults who had conversations before they filmed the scene about what would happen. Those conversations are not included, where the pre-negotiation about everything that's going to happen is worked out between the performers. And sometimes porn will show us someone being taken because people fantasize about that. They want to see their fantasies brought to life. But there was a negotiation. And you need to put those seeds in your kid's head. And with boys, you need to talk to your kid. You need to talk to your sons about misogyny, which is kind of a big word for a 10-year-old boy. Maybe just go with anger, that there is porn, a lot of it, that is created for men who are attracted to these women, desire them, and are angry at them, or and are mad at them because they don't feel like they could ever access them because they don't think that these women would ever give them the time of day. And so they want access to their bodies. They want to be able to look, but they know on some level they'll never be able to touch. And they want to see those women punished. And so there's a lot of anger and rage, male anger and rage that is in porn. And you say to your kid, don't succumb to the anger and the rage, because then you'll be that guy that women don't want to touch. You'll be that guy who's mad. And that's not attractive. It's repulsive. And it becomes a self-reinforcing, self-destructive, adult sex life disabling problem. And you don't want to succumb to that. So look out for anger in porn. And if they understand what it is, why it's there, they're less likely to be sucked into that rage. Ah, sorry, that was a long rant. Take your kid's phone away.
Hey, Dan, Nancy, and the Tech Savvy At-Risk Youth. I'm a long, long, long time listener. I just saw my first Hump show this weekend, which was phenomenal, with my awesome GGG boyfriend, who I love very much. And just now we had a bit of a quandary arise. So we've been together for about 6 months. Early on in our relationship, he made it very clear that he really enjoys eating ass and has been joyfully eating my ass ever since. He also expressed an interest in me doing the same for him, and I told him promptly that I will go to my grave and they will mark my headstone with the words, "She never ate ass." I've stood my ground thus far, and around that same time when we had that initial conversation, he listed off a few of his exes who had performed that act upon him. And I had sort of tossed that around in my head for a bit. I definitely like to be the best for my lover. And it kind of did a number on my head. His most recent ex in particular is somebody I'm not very fond of. And it kind of messed with me because I didn't want her to have done this thing for him that I hadn't done. Again, I stood my ground. But today, he revealed that she had never actually done that, that it had been a lie, and that he had been attempting to sort of manipulate me into doing this thing for him that I was not comfortable with. I feel good about the fact that I held my boundaries, but I'm trying to gauge how big of a deal this is. On the one hand, I feel like it's not that big of a deal because I stood my ground. But at the same time, if I had gone ahead and done that because I felt this sort of inferiority thing and then found out that it was a lie, I would be totally, I mean, it would be a violation. It would feel like coercion, and it would feel like I had done that thing under false pretenses. So I'm not going to break up with him. It doesn't feel like a DTMFA situation. He's wonderful in so many other ways. It was very early on in our relationship when this happened. I know the white lie clause, according to you, my emotional and relationship guru. Dan, help.
How big a deal is this that he told you this lie about his ex-girlfriend eating his ass? I guess it's a deal. Obviously, it's not a big enough deal that you're thinking about breaking up with him. You're not going to break up with him. You've already concluded it's not a big enough deal to break up with him over. But it is a deal. And maybe it's a big enough deal that he needs to apologize to you for manipulating you with that lie, or attempting to manipulate you with that lie, and very nearly getting your tongue into his ass on the strength of that lie, because you have this competitive spirit and you didn't want his ex-girlfriend to have done something for him or provided him with a pleasure that you haven't provided him with. So it very nearly worked. And then you wouldn't have been able to have "She never ate ass" on your tombstone because you almost ate his ass. And he needs to apologize. And he needs to promise you, if you guys are going to stay together, that he's not going to tell you lies about his previous relationships, past experiences, in an effort to get you to do things with him, that you need to have a clean and honest negotiation with him about the sexual adventures that you two are going to go on together. All that said about eating ass, I was curious about your desire, your life goal, your aspiration to have "she never ate ass" on your tombstone. And I was curious as to whether that's something that people could do, something that explicit on tombstone. To help answer that question, joining us by phone, Caitlin Doty, host of Ask a Mortician on YouTube, author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and the new book, From Here to Eternity. Caitlin, thank you for jumping on the phone.
I was told that I would be able to answer the ass-eating question.
Oh, you can start there.
I discover that you're only having me here to talk about tombstone etiquette.
If we can talk about ass-eating. Let's talk about ass-eating first. I don't want to pigeonhole you just as someone who can only talk about death.
No, I'm kidding. I don't know that I want people to know whether I'm qualified to talk about ass eating or not.
No stigma, no shame about ass eating.
Yeah, exactly. No stigma, no shame. Everyone should be able to talk. Like death, it's a hard topic. Everyone should be able to have an open discussion about it.
All right. So the death angle here, the tombstone angle. Could you have something on a tombstone that was that sexually explicit? Can you get, like, "I had a big cock, it was a good ride" on your tombstone, or "she never ate ass" on a tombstone?
My instinct is no, just because, especially in America, cemeteries are privately run for the most part, and they get to decide the aesthetic and the vibe and what goes on headstones. So, for example, there was a huge controversy a couple years ago at this historic cemetery where, for some reason, one of the employees allowed a veteran to get big SpongeBob SquarePants tombstones in this beautiful historic cemetery. And then, of course, the head of the cemetery comes in and goes, no, you can't have big giant SpongeBob SquarePants headstones in the cemetery. Riots happened, not real riots, but riots among the family. Everyone's upset. You do see a lot of really snappy, fun, interesting headstones, but I think eating ass would not make it past the cemetery etiquette board.
So maybe you could have that stitched into your burial shroud and take it to the grave. Literally take it to the grave.
Exactly. You could have it written on your casket. Not a lot of people are buried in America anymore. That number is going down. You're probably more likely to be cremated. So in that case, you can certainly get an urn for your home that says that very broadly across it.
She never ate. And someday your grandkids or your great-grandchildren, your great-great-grandchildren will look at that urn and think, "Great grandma never ate ass."
Exactly. And, you know, who knows how that will age? That will either be like a feminist sentiment or like, "Oh, grandma, what a prude you were."
Yeah. Here in 2046, everybody ass is all that's left because of the environmental degradation of the earth. Ass is all we have to eat.
The beauty of the urn is that you could get an actual ass shaped urn if you want. You know, the urn just lives in your home. So whatever you want, you know, to do with that is up to you and your loved ones.
I'm a morbid dude. And whenever I travel in the States, wherever I go, I visit cemeteries and I like to look at tombstones. I like to read what's on them. I'm always really interested when I find a tombstone that has a kind of enigmatic or revealing or intriguing poem or short expression. And with fewer and fewer people being buried, and with so many people who are still being buried, just getting those little flat, boring marble, like, shoebox lid shaped plaques level to the grass. Like, I worry about, you know, tombstones 100 years from now aren't going to be very interesting or even really exist at all. Sometimes it's a little nerving how often my husband asks me how I would like him to dispose of my remains. And I always say, I want to be buried. I want a big casket. I want to be embalmed. And I want a tombstone that sticks up out of the ground that says something on it, funny or interesting or intriguing. Because I want to be that. I want that tombstone that somebody reads in 100 years from now and goes, "Huh, what was that about? Who the fuck was he? To be mine. Is that weird?"
No, not at all. Well, that, I think he asks you so much because your husband and I follow each other on Instagram. And so I am always thinking about Tom of Finland, and he is always thinking about death and death of those he loves. So good for him for having that conversation with you. But no, I don't think so at all. And I think that, but the problem is that we're already in that place. Already the American style of death is those flat, you know, just rectangle, flat to the ground.
So boring.
One tiny phrase on it. It's really boring. I agree.
It's a cemetery designed for the convenience of the lawnmower.
Exactly. Yep. That's, and that you think you're being, you know, funny, but that's 100% true. That's why it is done. It's more convenient for the landscapers to mow right over. And it's much harder to have these big, beautiful monuments or unique headstones. But I think unless we're going to have cemeteries like that, what is the use of the modern cemetery at all if you're not going to have these unique, beautiful monuments that say sassy things?
I want unique, beautiful monuments to say sassy things. And, you know, that whole, like, we have to redesign the cemetery and monuments for the convenience of the lawnmower just presupposes that it has to look like a gorgeous trimmed lawn everywhere. Why not let it be an overgrown kind of semi-wild space where the grass is uneven and there are bushes and trees and flowers and shrubs growing up around tombstones? Why does everything have to look like a fucking golf course?
You're preaching to the choir with me. That's I will say that one of the biggest innovations we have right now is a green burial cemetery, or is a conservation cemetery, where it's exactly that way. Someone will be buried and there'll be a pile of mulch over them where you can actually tell where the body was. God forbid we know that there are actual dead bodies buried in a cemetery. Some of the headstones will be pieces of driftwood that have been carved into something, or something that's a natural plant or a bush. So you can live on, maybe not with a sassy saying, but with a tree that you like or a bush that you like. So you can contribute your particular touch or particular interest in another way that's not necessarily a marble headstone.
I want a marble headstone. I want something that sticks out of the ground that says Google Santorum or something that then people
go home.
And like,
maybe, I mean, you could also, you're potentially up for like a, you know, statue in the town square. pull down a Confederate statue and put up a Dan Savage.
Yeah, I think that would be met with a little bit of pushback from the far left and far right, but it's nice to think about. We have gone far afield in our conversation from the whole ass-eating point of the question, but
Won't anybody remember the ass-eating in this?
Do you think there's ass eating in the afterlife? Do you believe in an afterlife?
I don't believe in an afterlife, but I'd like to think that's one of the things that happens there.
If there's an afterlife worth living, there's ass eating in that afterlife, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, that could also go on something. Maybe you should just get coffee mugs for now.
Tea towels.
Tea towels, yeah.
Caitlin Doty, author of the new book, From Here to Eternity, author of the tremendously wonderful best-selling book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Check out her new book. And to find out more about Caitlin, her work, and to learn more about what's going on in the death movement, funeral movement, what do you call it?
Death positive movement actually has really caught on as of late. But yeah, good death movement.
The good death movement. Go to orderofthegooddeath.com. Caitlin, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us.
Thank you, Dan.
Hey, Dan, I'm a 26-year-old bi lady, and I've been seeing this guy for about 5 months, and he's really great. We have a strong connection, and it's made me feel romantically fulfilled in a way that I didn't really think was possible for me, which has been refreshing, and it's made me really happy. There's one weird issue, and it's his boss. He's got an awesome job that allows him to travel a lot, and he also works a lot of variety events. He and his boss have a professional and a personal relationship that I honestly don't understand, but I'm doing my best to try. They're good friends as well as employer-employee. He describes their relationship as a Liz Lemon, Jack Donaghy type situation from 30 Rock, where he's Liz and she's Jack. And like Jack Donaghy, his boss is incredibly wealthy, like ridiculously so. I've never seen so much extravagant wealth in my life. But here's the problem. He doesn't like me. We've had only a few encounters, but in all but one of them, she's been incredibly rude to me. She, like, I will try to make conversation with her and she will not even acknowledge that I'm speaking. And she has said insulting things to my boyfriend about me. And he defends me and tells her that she's being mean and unreasonable, which I appreciate. They had a bit of a fight about it, and she confessed that she gets upset when her friends start dating new people or getting married, because then they stop spending time with her, and she admitted that that was not a good quality in her. She admitted that was not a supportive friend of her, and I guess that she said she'd stop, but she kind of didn't. But the whole thing just kind of weirds me out. Like, she's his boss. Why is her nose so far into our relationship? But I know that she's an important part of his life, so I'm trying my best to be really supportive of it, and I want to get along with her, but I'm so uncomfortable when I'm around her. I know this weird issue she's had with me or has with me puts a strain on him, and I want us to be able to get along so that he's more comfortable and that I can be more included in his life, but I just don't know how to be supportive of this weird relationship that I don't understand, especially when she's so unfriendly to me in person. I've tried talking to him about it, my feelings of discomfort, and he says I haven't made much of an effort to reach out to her either, which I guess I can admit is true, but partly because I'm so fucking nervous around her. It's just partly because I feel like she has so much power here because she's his employer and she's also fucking rich as hell and she kind of throws that around. It's gotten to the point where I start to feel uncomfortable when he mentions her or texts her, even though I know it's about completely harmless things like work or events that they're working coming up. But I guess I would just love some advice on how to navigate this weird situation and be supportive of my boyfriend and our relationship. How to feel more comfortable with this whole thing.
Your boyfriend isn't the only one out there in a situation like this. According to CNN, CNN reports, a work spouse is a coworker of the opposite sex with whom you have a close platonic relationship. In many ways, these relationships can mirror a real marriage. According to a 2007 survey from Vault.com, 23% of workers reported that they had a work spouse. So your boyfriend isn't the only one out there who has this kind of oddly intimate, platonic working relationship with someone that feels or looks to others much like a marital relationship. And feeling that and seeing that if you're the girlfriend or spouse of someone who's in one of those work relationships, that can be super duper awkward. Now, I'm going to give you some advice that I don't really want to give you, and I hate giving you because I hate it that we live in a world and at a time and in a plutocracy, a kakistocracy, where the rich get every goddamn thing that they want. But the boss has unpacked for you, the boss has told you, told your boyfriend, what it is about your presence in his life that she finds threatening and why she's unpleasant to people who are close to her, people that she employs, and a lot of obscenely wealthy people have no real friends. They have dependents of all sorts. She's told you both why she's acting the way she's acting, why she treats you the way she treats you. Because when she gets close to someone that she employs or not, and they get into a romantic relationship or marry, they have less time for her and she sees less of them. So she regards you as a threat, and she's going to continue to regard you as a threat so long as you aren't her very good friend too. Kills me to say that. You need to strategize with your boyfriend. How long is he going to have this job? Is this a job he's going to have for the rest of his fucking life? Does he want to work for this insanely wealthy woman forever? Or is there a window, is there a horizon where there's going to be a conclusion to their professional relationship? And so not having a great and close and personal friendship with you too won't be a problem. But right now it's a problem. So your best bet to de-escalate this situation and to make your boyfriend's work relationship copacetic and not to put your boyfriend in a position where he feels consciously or subconsciously that he's facing a choice between his employment, his income, and his girlfriend, you need to buddy up to this woman a little bit. You need to, not because you should have to, but because strategically it might be in your best interest and in your boyfriend's best interest and in the best interest of your relationship. Make an effort, like your boyfriend said, to be friendly to this person in the teeth of her unpleasantness to you, to wear it down. Or you can go to war. You can stand your ground and you can put your boyfriend in a situation where he feels like he's going to have to choose. And there's no guarantee that he'll choose you. But I think you should bring your boyfriend in on this. I think this should be a plot that you both hatch together, not to kill her and steal her money, but for you to have a relationship with her that makes her feel like even if you and your boyfriend continue to get closer, she's not going to lose anything. Because if we know anything about the super wealthy in America right now, they can't stand to lose anything ever. Not saying this is the way it should be, but this right now for you and your boyfriend, it's kind of the way that it is. It would gall me to have to do it. It galls me to advise you to do it. I hope your boyfriend has his resume together and there is coming soon termination date for this work relationship with his kind of toxic sounding asshole super wealthy boss.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in regards to your episode 590 and the woman that was talking about her creeper boyfriend of her mom. And you gave great advice, but I think one thing you left out is that these creepers like to have things be secret. And I think that without having to tell her mom all her concerns, she could just bring her mom to the conversation. So, for example, the first time he PayPal'd her money, she should just call her mom and say, hey, I just got that money. I'm not sure if it was from you and him or just him, but, you know, when you see him, thank him for PayPaling the money. And if he texts you, just respond back and loop your mom in on that group text. You know, add your mom into the text and say, thanks for the invite to the pool. Mom, what day are you going? And just make every conversation with him a three-way call. And I think that that will be a good way to make sure all of this is happening in public.
Hey, Dan, just calling in about a caller from the February 13th show who saw a couple of men dressed up in baby doll outfits and was wondering what to tell their child. This actually sounds like someone I know. And I can tell you that what they are doing is not a pre-sexual thing to warm up or anything like that. They are expressing who they feel they are. These are men who worked in conservative areas of life that were never able to dress the way they wanted to dress. And they can now because they're retired and they don't have the pressures. I've seen pictures posted on Facebook of my friend. This is how he dresses 24/7 because it's who he thinks he is and how he feels he wants to present himself to the world. So she should tell her child this is a man being honest to himself and to the rest of us as to who he is and how he wants to express himself. And there doesn't have to be any sex involved at all because this dress is not a precursor to sex for him, most likely.
I want to leave a message for the caller on episode 590 whose boyfriend is addicted to crystal. I was that person 15 years ago. I was a mess. I was shooting up. I was having a lot of indiscriminate sex and lying to my friends, and I was a disaster. I needed to hear from my friends that they didn't want to be around me anymore. They couldn't stand the way I looked. They couldn't stand that I canceled engagements with them. I was a disaster. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Say it lovingly, say it with care, help him get the help he needs. But if he won't get help, there's nothing you can do about it. Crystal is a very powerful thing. And kicking it was the hardest thing I ever did in my entire life. And I'm 53 years old. So help him do it. If he can't or won't, then leave him. It's that simple.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you'd like to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. If you are shirtless, we can fix that. Go to savagelovecast.com. Click on shop. We have a new Savage Lovecast t-shirt for Savage Lovecast fans to make it easier for you guys to spot each other when you're out and about or at the gym. Go to savagelovecast.com and click on shop. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Roxanne Gay on Twitter at RGay. And follow Caitlin Doty on Twitter at TheGoodDeath. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Artunian. And me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with an installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thanks for